Hey, I hunted down a pretty dang smart cookie for today's podcast episode. Kenneth Ford. He runs this thing called the IHMC in Florida, and we talk about exoskeletons for human performance and whether robots are going to rule the world, ketosis for muscle gain, some cool fringe training tactics, and a lot more. His name is Kenneth Ford. I think you'll dig him.
All right, folks. Clinical research has shown that therapeutically and for overall health and well-being, the most critical time to ground is when you sleep. The electrons you absorb when grounding neutralizes free radical damage, squelches inflammation, restores healthy endocrine function, enhances cellular gating and circulation. That then improves the cellular uptake of nutrients and oxygen and hormones while maximizing the removal of cellular waste. And you can now ground when you sleep. This company called Ultimate Longevity makes indoor grounded sleeping devices. And they've done clinical research studies on grounding the human body for health. When you sleep on these mats, you get 6 to 8 hours of uninterrupted grounding, meaning I could travel, unroll it onto my hotel room bed, and fight all of the radiation, the inflammation I got from flying in the airplane right there during a full night of sleep. Full body grounding, which is what these mats give you versus just your feet on the ground, maximizes the electron transfer because the more surface area contact, the more beneficial the electrons, the more the results. So you get these amazing benefits. And inside your body, this stream of electrons works as an anti-inflammatory, pain-relieving, anti-aging, antioxidant boost, squelching inflammation all night long. They've got over 20 peer-reviewed research studies that have been published on the extensive health benefits of grounding. For vagal tone, serum electrolytes, thyroid function, blood glucose, blood viscosity, sleep, pain, stiffness, blood pressure, stress, even depression and anxiety. It's crazy. So you can go to ultimatelongevity.com/Ben to get your hands on these grounding mats. You can do mattress, pillow, blankets, a whole bunch of other valuable tools to help you bring your inflammation down and jumpstart your healing process. Again, it's ultimatelongevity.com/Ben. Well, folks, you and I, or the average American at least, spend an average of 90% of time indoors, breathing around 30,000 gallons of air daily. According to the EPA, indoor air can be 2 to 5 times more polluted than outdoor air, and in some cases, 100 times more polluted, especially like your home gym where you're breathing in even more air. This can be a serious issue. Data shows that air pollution is responsible for nearly 7 million premature deaths around the world. So you need air purifying technology. And the one that I like as a standalone system that doesn't require you to go re-outfit your entire home's AC system or ducts is called the Air Doctor. The Air Doctor filters out dangerous contaminants and allergens like pollen, pet dander, dust mites, and mold. So your lungs don't need to. Their Ultra HEPA filter has been independently tested to remove 99.99% of tested bacteria and viruses and virtually 100% of particles as small as 0.003 microns. They also feature whisper jet fans, 30% quieter than normal ordinary air purifiers, and they are extremely affordable and accessible. Furthermore, they're going to give you up to 39% off of one of their extremely impressive and efficacious air filters, or up to $300 off today. Here's how you lock this in. You go to airdoctorpro.com/BenG. You can get one with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund, minus shipping, but you're going to love it. airdoctorpro.com/BenG. You'll get up to 39% off or up to $300 off. So lock it in today, folks. You'll enjoy it. Clean air is something everybody deserves. You can get it with the Air Doctor.
In this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Show, you know, one size doesn't fit all, and what's good for one isn't good for the other. But I think an intelligent supplementation program, especially depending on your diet, you know, so for people that are in ketosis, carnitine, both LCAR and the tartrate form, I think are important.
But also you couple that with decreased anabolic hormone production as you age, right? We all know that. So you typically see lower levels of testosterone, IGF-1, and other anabolic elements.
He's an expert in human performance and nutrition. Voted America's top personal trainer and one of the globe's most influential people in health and fitness. His show provides you with everything you need to optimize physical and mental performance. He is Ben Greenfield.
Power. Speed. Mobility. Balance. Whatever it is for you, that's the natural movement. Get out there. When you look at all the studies done, studies that have shown the greatest efficacy.
All the information you need in one place, right here, right now, on the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
Hey folks, it's Ben Greenfield here, and as I always am doing, I'm constantly on a quest to kind of keep my ear to the ground, so to speak, about very cool new ways for you to harness information on everything from fitness tactics to biohacking to ketosis and nutrition and exercising outdoors and optimizing the mind and body and spirit. And so I occasionally come across individuals who I feel would be a really good fit to kind of speak to a lot of parts of that spectrum that I just described. And my guest on today's show is really no exception. He actually has a really good podcast I've listened to a few times. It's called the STEM Talk Podcast. We'll talk about that later. But his name is Ken Ford. And Ken is the founder and the CEO of what's called the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition. That's a mouthful. It's abbreviated IHMC, and it's actually one of the nation's top research organizations that investigates everything from like AI to extending human cognition to locomotion to resilience. They describe it as a new model for interdisciplinary research that strives to be both entrepreneurial and academic. And I would say based on the podcast that I've heard Ken record, he's certainly achieving that. He's authored hundreds of scientific papers. He's got 6 books out there. I'll link to his websites in the show notes for today's show, which you can access at bengreenfieldfitness.com/KenFord if you want to learn a little bit more about Ken and what he does. And in our emails back and forth, and I think it was another fellow podcaster, Rob Wolf, who may have introduced us. If I remember correctly, that's who it was. But in our emails back and forth, I discovered that Ken has a lot of other interests too, and you know, everything from steel bicycles and outdoor training to anti-aging, to you know, using biohacks like power dots and vibration training, to blood flow restriction training, to a whole host of things that I think it'll turn this into a relatively fascinating discussion, or something that could go off the deep end pretty quickly, I'll warn you. So anyways, Ken, welcome to the show, man.
Great, good to be here.
Yeah, well, it's fantastic to have you. And you know, I guess the first place that I'd like to start is this mouthful of a place that you work at, this IHMC. What exactly is that, man? Because I'm intrigued. I don't quite have my head wrapped around what you do.
Yeah, it's an unpoetic acronym. You know, some people think it means I hate my cubicle, or you know, all kinds of other potential meanings. But as you said, it means Institute for Human and Machine Cognition. And what that is IHMC is a not-for-profit research lab that focuses on developing science and technology in service of leveraging and extending human performance. So it starts with the human. That's why the human comes first in our name. And then by whatever means necessary or in whatever means appropriate, we work to extend human performance. And by performance, I mean cognitive performance, perceptual performance, and locomotion, movement, as well as resilience. Increasing human resilience is one of our focus areas.
What's an example of something you guys have done?
Well, you know, we work from robotics to AI, to exoskeletons for paraplegics, to exoskeletons for superhuman performance, to ketone work, you know, broad range of subjects.
Okay. I have to ask, the exoskeleton for human performance, what is that?
Well, there's a couple groups working on that. Ours was for NASA, and it was for providing both exercise in space, but also, if necessary, for example, in a spacesuit on a planet with sufficient gravity, you might need extra strength. And the military has worked on several exoskeletons for increased performance, essentially robots that you wear.
Really? So how do you actually design one of those? Like what's a robot that you wear do? Is it just a bunch of joints and metal pieces that move like Iron Man? Or describe to me how this looks.
Essentially, it's a machine that's fitted to the human. And this is a complicated thing to do. It's difficult to relatively painlessly and seamlessly fit a machine that follows human motion and then amplifies our abilities. And again, these could be physical abilities, and they usually are, but also cognitive, for example, or perception.
So when you're doing an exoskeleton for human performance, does one of these actually exist, or are you guys just kind of researching it right now?
Several exist, and none of them are suitable for prime time. These are all research machines that have cables and wires hanging off them and intermittently break. The what's driving exoskeletons, both in terms of increased human performance and also for paraplegics, is really these much improved actuators over the last few years. So we have excellent force control actuators now that enable these kinds of devices, as well as a new category of exercise device that will be a spin-off of these machines and of these actuators.
What's the exercise device do?
Well, it's a force control motor-enabled exercise device. Again, it's built for NASA. You know, the exercise device they currently use on space station weighs 2,000 pounds. It's called ARED. And it's reasonably efficacious on space station, but you can't bring it anywhere. It's too big to bring beyond low Earth orbit. And without the space shuttle, you couldn't even bring it there. So essentially, in the future, the in-space exercise devices will be motor-controlled or even rely on things like bands. But they need to weigh something like 50 pounds or less and have very low power consumption. And I think these sorts of devices will have a big spin-off from space, as many things have, into the normal market channel.
So rather than like going to the gym to exercise, you would just be able to like put on a suit.
Yes, or you would use one of these new exercise devices that are derivative from exoskeletons, but not themselves an exoskeleton. And with the force control motors, you can have the force or the load be a function of any input. So it could be a function of position, it could be a function of rate of motion, it could be a function of heart rate, it could be a random function. This would be both safer but more efficacious as well, because you could do, for example, heavy eccentric squats.
Right.
Very, very heavy squats. Well, that's hard to do at home, or that's even hard to do in the gym, unless you've got some big guys helping you with the barbell.
Right. Or unless you have like one of these ArcsFit machines.
Exactly.
That's pretty expensive and more of like an industrial machine.
Yeah. And they're very large. I actually like the ArcsFit machines. I work out with them sometimes, but they are big and you wouldn't take them on a deep space mission.
Right.
And so the next sort of development of that idea, that kind of idea, are the sort of machines that we're talking about.
So what you're saying is you could wear this machine that would, for example, force you downwards in an eccentric squat pattern and then allow you to stand up, remove the load, and then force you downwards again as an example of something you could do.
Right. And so the current version of the device, you don't need to wear. You get in it in a position very much like if you're doing squats, it's very much like a barbell squat. And you get in the position, but there's no load on the bar, right? And then the machine, the bar, starts to load, and it essentially feels like it's trying to pull you down through the floor. And you're resisting being squashed like a bug. And so every rep is pretty devastating, much like ARX. That thing will wipe you out pretty quick. And then you stand up with very little resistance, and rinse, wash, and repeat the cycle. The motor is directly programmable and is a force control motor, so it can exquisitely control the loads.
Wow, this is so cool. And I think a lot of people probably hear this and think about, this idea of like artificial intelligence, being built into an exoskeleton robot and robots running down the street killing people. And I actually wanted to ask you about about this idea behind artificial intelligence and where it fits into this equation, because I know you guys do a lot of work on artificial intelligence as well, right?
Right. In fact, that's my primary research area, and it's one of the largest and most important research areas here at the lab.
So what are you studying right now when it comes to artificial intelligence?
Well, we have a lot of areas of focus, but one of the biggest areas of focus is language, human-computer interaction and dialogue. By that, I don't mean speech recognition. I mean the actual understanding, where the computer is understanding the intent and the meaning of what you said, and then responding in an appropriate way.
Interesting. So when it comes to the AI that you're developing, are you doing anything when it comes to like the exercise or the fitness or the performance market?
No, most of our AI work is for organizations like DARPA and for other research organizations in the government. And it's mostly, as I said, focused either on language and dialogue or on robotics and in, you know, sort of endowing our machines with some degree of initiative and ability to make rational choices.
Yeah, interesting. Well, I mean, it sounds like maybe like an exercise machine could, for example, be equipped with enough artificial intelligence to detect and change your own movements or your own strength patterns. You know, almost like that like that ArcsFit machine does. You know, it detects when your force curve drops off, and then that's the end of the set.
Yeah. And that doesn't require AI, but you're onto something, Ben, because, you know, the next generation of these machines well could employ AI techniques. And, you know, the newer machines will know when you're out of balance and when your loads are inappropriate on your feet, and it'll provide an additional cushion or safety, an increased element of safety as well as efficacy.
Now, there's something I saw recently from Elon Musk where he talks about how there needs to be some kind of like artificial intelligence legislation created, because AI could, I think the way he phrased it was there was a higher risk of AI going rogue at this point than North Korea. But like when you're working with AI, what are your thoughts on a lot of talk about the risks or the potential for robots to rule the world?
Yeah, who knows why he says these things. I think he's either trying to entertain himself or test how credulous the media is. But, you know, AI is a field of intellectual inquiry. It's an academic field of study and then a commercial area of development. It's not a thing that runs amok. It's, you know, when people refer to an AI in the singular, as he and others do, it's akin to me saying something like this. Toward the end of World War II, the United States dropped a physics on Japan. No, we didn't drop a physics, right? We dropped a bomb. We dropped the product of physics. And there's not an area of human inquiry that should be off limits. In fact, Musk tries to be a leader in automotive AI. So it's kind of a strange thing to be saying. You know, it's an old story, though. If you look at heavier-than-air flight, we used to call it AF, artificial flight. And now no one would call it artificial flight. It really, truly is flying. But there was great outrage. And, you know, in the early days of artificial flight, it was seen to be the greatest threat facing humanity. And just like artificial flight, AI can be used for good or ill. And it depends on the wisdom of the society and the culture that wields that capability.
Yeah, that's super interesting. Hey, but by the way, are there any photographs online of these exoskeletons that you're talking about?
Sure, I can send you some.
Yeah, send me some and I'll put them in the show notes. And again, for those of you listening, just go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/KenFord, because I'm personally curious how closely they resemble Iron Man. That's really all I want to know. just because I have a secret desire and a bucket list wish to be able to fight Captain America one day. You talked about a little bit earlier the ketogenic diet, and I know that you guys have done some research on that. And from what I understand, like it's something that you personally got into Apparently, even before ketosis became the sexy latest diet trend and everybody and their dog were, you know, shoveling exogenous ketones into their gaping maw. I'm curious how you got into being interested in something like ketosis.
Sure. That's a long and old story, but I'll give you the short version. I first became aware of the ketogenic diet in the late 60s or early 70s when I was cutting weight for wrestling. And, you know, this diet, like any other way of eating, is not ideal for everyone. But for a wrestler, it was great because I was able to effectively cut weight and maintain muscle mass. And that's tough. You know, in the off season in wrestling, you tend to gain both weight, both fat and muscle. And then the season comes. And if you're a lightweight, you've got a significant amount of weight. And so that's what got me into it. I had never heard of the ketogenic diet, but I had a problem with seizures. And wrestling is impossible on phenobarbital.
Oh, wow.
And so I didn't seize. I quit taking the phenobarbital and didn't seize. And it turned out the neurologist explained to me that, well, you must be in ketosis. And that's the first time I ever heard the word. So I was in starvation ketosis. You know, I was wrestling. I was a freshman. And I was wrestling 119. And normally I weighed about 160. And so I was cutting to get to 119. And that was that. So I maintained it most of my life. I went out a few times with negative consequences, but generally I'm most days well ensconced in ketosis.
Interesting. So what would a typical day of eating look like for you right now?
Well, I usually have an early, dinner and, I hate eating late. So I like to have an early dinner. And I usually skip breakfast and then have lunch. So it's about a 16 or 17 hour gap between dinner and the next meal. But I like to mix things up. So like today I had a nice breakfast of grass-fed beef and three egg yolks cooked in butter, lots of espresso, that kind of thing.
Interesting. Now, you guys do research on ketosis too.
Yes. In particular, on the effects, the performance effects of the ketone esters and the diet. You know, again, as I mentioned earlier, we like to apply technology and science in the service of the human experience. So we're interested in, you know, can you perform better? Whether it's AI, you know, we're not trying to make a standalone AI like some goofy science fiction AI. We're trying to make us all smarter. So for our point of view, AI should stand for augmented intelligence or amplified intelligence. And so this is true for nutrition as well. So we're looking, when we look at something like ketones, we want to know, does it make you more resilient? You know, can you operate in places a human otherwise can't effectively operate? Can you operate at a higher physical level? And can you operate in a better cognitive level?
Interesting. For me, you know, I first started getting into ketosis when I was racing Ironman triathlon, and I was looking for ways to increase endurance and get a fuel source for the liver and the heart and the diaphragm that was a little bit longer lasting and stable than like maltodextrin or fructose. And so I started, first of all, just shifting to a lower carbohydrate, higher fat intake, and then to using things like MCT oil, you know, during the race. And then I'd combine that with exogenous ketones and amino acids and electrolytes, and kind of eventually had like a whole cocktail that I'd race on and have enormous amounts of endurance for something like a, you know, like an ultra endurance event, like an Ironman. So I can definitely personally attest to the resilience factor there. But I'm curious what you guys have studied. What areas of resilience have you found something like a ketone to be effective for? And also don't let me forget to mention or highlight the fact that you said ketone esters. And I'm curious, you know, why you're using those versus what you find in most supplements these days, which would be a ketone salt.
Okay. Well, you know, some of it is stuff that not at leisure to talk about, but you can imagine that our customer base are the research agencies and organizations in support of NASA and the Department of Defense. And so in general, we would be looking at important measures of either perceptual acuity, cognitive function, or physical function. One I can tell you about that we will be doing is looking at the effect of ketone esters in hypoxia. So if you reduce the oxygen available to a human, some very predictable things happen. Now, if you reduce it to zero, the most predictable thing happens. But on the way to zero, all kinds of predictable degradations in performance happen. And we're interested in knowing, for example, would a ketone ester mitigate some of those cognitive and visual performance decrements?
So when you're using a ketone ester, why did you make that choice versus a salt?
Well, it would depend on the application, but for most of our applications, we would, in fact, as you suggest, use the ester. The reason is that the esters will much more greatly elevate the circulating blood ketone body level. And in many cases, we want to make sure that we're getting an effect. So the ketone salts are great for what they are. And if you're eating the ketogenic diet and the person needs a little boost, you might get a 1 millimolar boost or half a millimolar boost. With the esters, the person does not need to be consuming the diet and will be very quickly around 4 millimolars or higher.
Yeah, it's through the roof. I have a video somewhere of me getting ready to race a Tough Mudder, and I swallowed a bottle of this, the exogenous, the ketone esters I got from Dr. Jeff Veach's lab, because I had interviewed him about esters. And then I tested, and I did this on camera. And so my ketones at rest were at, whatever, one millimolar or slightly below what you would expect like a fat adapted athlete to be at. And then I chugged this bottle and they went up to like 8.0 by about the 20-minute mark. So it was crazy. It was almost like cheating. Now, of course, I always question, and I'd love to hear your take on this, like how natural that is for the human body, like even from an ancestral or an evolutionary standpoint. You don't see situations in the past where humans would have had access to copious amounts of ketones all at once. And although I don't necessarily make every decision by the rule that I'm only going to do it if our ancestors would have done it, I'm a total fan of better living through science. But I'm wondering what you feel about the potential physiological implications of something like that.
Well, that's an interesting question. And, the folks that are well-informed and sensible have different opinions on it. I think it's important to make the distinction between the things you do to achieve peak performance in sport, especially elites, or in elite warfighting, or that you might do for space travel. Those things you might do might not necessarily be what you would do for longevity or health span. So in the case of exogenous ketones, I think the right answer is that nobody knows what the long-term effects would be. We see so many positive effects that I would think the effects generally would be good, but it's not a state that humans have traditionally been in. And this is why there's a great need for research in the area. But the diet, I am very confident for most people, is a step in the right direction. And a large number of people are essentially metabolically broken. They have neurodegenerative disorders or other disease states, for which I think the ketone esters would be a blessing. So it's in general, I'm very optimistic about them.
Yeah. One thing that you mentioned when you were talking about how you first became experienced with that diet when you were a wrestler and trying to lose fat without losing too much muscle is this idea behind whether or not you really can adequately avoid, whether it is muscle loss or whether you can gain muscle, or perhaps, could you even avoid like age-related loss of muscle mass or muscle function with a strategy like this? And I know this is something that you've looked into a little bit, and I'm curious what you've found when it comes to ketones and muscle, and specifically, are they gaining muscle or just not losing it?
Yes, it's a scenario of great interest to me. And it's one that's still taking shape. You know, the science is just emerging on this. And essentially, you know, everyone has seen the age-related loss of muscle. You see it in people around you every day. You see it in your family members. And it's a major challenge for society and for the aging population in general, leading to frailty and, you know, the loss of independence. And we sometimes hear this phenomena called sarcopenia, or perhaps better, the word dyspnea. You know, sarcopenia talks about, what it implies is a poverty of flesh. It's about the loss of muscle mass. And for the aging population, that is a problem, but it's not the big problem. The big problem is dyspnea, which is the age-related loss of strength and power.
You call that dyspnea?
Right. And as we age, we lose strength and power much more quickly than we lose mass. And so that's really at the heart of the problem. And the causes for this loss of muscle mass and quality, when I say quality, I mean power and strength, right, is multifactorial. It's not one of these simple things you hear. You know, you hear somebody blogging away and they'll say, oh, it's because of this. No, it's complicated. And it has to do with most of the components of aging. And I would say insulin resistance and its cousin anabolic resistance are huge players. So anabolic resistance is quite like insulin resistance that you're very familiar with. But also you couple that with decreased anabolic hormone production as you age, right? We all know that.
Right.
So you typically see lower levels of testosterone, IGF-1, and other anabolic elements. And myostatin is really not your friend at some point. And as you age, myostatin signaling goes up a lot. Mm-hmm. And then as you age, you get chronic inflammation and you have declining autophagy and all kinds of mitochondrial abnormalities and, you know, reduction in satellite cell effectiveness. And, so it's a tough road. You've decreased motor neuron units. I'm sure I'm forgetting tons and tons of it. Muscle fiber denervation. But you get the point. But interestingly, think about those things I just said. Most of them are affected by the ketogenic diet. And it's not curative with respect to these things, but it moves the needle in a positive direction, which is one of the reasons why I'm optimistic about ketone esters as well, as I mentioned earlier. And so in my view, the benefits of the ketogenic diet are greater as we age. You know, as we age, most of us are, to some degree, increasingly insulin resistant and increasingly pudgy, and you see it, you know, in the general population, and it's where I think the diet will make the biggest difference. And in the last year, there must be 10 papers dealing with ketogenic diet and longevity, and some of them have dealt directly with health span. And to me, strength and health into old age is more important than just living a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody told me that there's a podcaster out there that claims he's going to live to 180. Well, you know, I really don't want to live to 180. I want to square the aging
curve. I'll live to 180 if I can still be having sex and playing tennis when I'm 175. Otherwise, I don't have a deep desire.
That's a big F.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, these new papers are really stressing the role of ketones not as energy sources, but as signaling agents. And the papers are the science is somewhat complicated, but it's fascinating. So you see tissue-specific effects of the ketones. So specific to muscle tissue, a different effect than you do in the liver, for example. So in many of these things, you want, for longevity, you would like reduced circulating IGF-1. You would like reduced mTOR activation. But to maintain muscle mass, you want elevated mTOR. You want elevated IGF-1. So normally these would be seen as in conflict. And what's being teased apart now is the tissue-dependent nature, where you can have increased sensitivity to say IGF-1 in the muscle while circulating IGF-1 is reduced in ketogenic diet about 30%. Same with mTOR activation. And this is really exciting to me. And this area is going to be one of real focus in the next few years in the research literature.
Interesting. So could you get a lot of the benefits that you've just described using a ketone ester and eating perhaps a non-ketogenic diet versus eating a strict high-fat diet, do you think?
And the answer is no one knows. So you mentioned Dr. Veach earlier. He's just a wonderful man. And his view is yes. And so in his view, he is not a fan of the diet. And I'll say again that I am, right? But in his view, especially when you think about an aging population not interested in changing its lifestyle or its diet. He believes that these benefits and many others would accrue to those ingesting the esters. And in my case, I just don't know.
Yeah. The only thing that I would suspect could be deleterious would be simultaneous high blood glucose and high ketone levels, just because of the net acidic state that could create. That's something that I would be nervous about people doing, you know, eating their potatoes for breakfast and their sandwich for lunch and their bread for dinner, and then also taking a bunch of ketones at the same time. That's where I could see people going wrong.
Normally that wouldn't happen. So for a non-malfunctioning human, if you did that, and let's say you ate a bunch of potatoes and your glucose level was 110, and then you drank the ester, your glucose level would be probably 80.
Oh, really?
Sure.
So it's going to drop blood glucose level simply by putting the ketone into your body?
Right.
How does that occur mechanistically?
Well, you get an insulin response is part of the story. But it's more complicated than meets the eye at first. It's not clear, in my view, what the long-term safety profile of the esters are, and we can't know that, right? This is a new thing, with everything having to do with human health span, you make your choices. If we're going to wait for a random double-blind study, we'll both be dead before that's done in humans.
Right.
All right, folks. Clinical research has shown that therapeutically and for overall health and well-being, the most critical time to ground is when you sleep. The electrons you absorb when grounding neutralizes free radical damage, squelches inflammation, restores healthy endocrine function, enhances cellular gating and circulation. That then improves the cellular uptake of nutrients and oxygen and hormones while maximizing the removal of cellular waste. And you can now ground when you sleep. This company called Ultimate Longevity makes indoor grounded sleeping devices. And they've done clinical research studies on grounding the human body for health. When you sleep on these mats, you get 6 to 8 hours of uninterrupted grounding, meaning I could travel, unroll it onto my hotel room bed, and fight all of the radiation, the inflammation I got from flying in the airplane right there during a full night of sleep. Full body grounding, which is what these mats give you, versus just your feet on the ground, maximizes the electron transfer, because the more surface area contact, the more beneficial the electrons, the more the results. So you get these amazing benefits. And inside your body, this stream of electrons works as an anti-inflammatory, pain-relieving, anti-aging, antioxidant boost, squelching inflammation all night long. They've got over 20 peer-reviewed research studies that have been published on the extensive health benefits of grounding. For vagal tone, serum electrolytes, thyroid function, blood glucose, blood viscosity, sleep, pain, stiffness, blood pressure, stress, even depression and anxiety. It's crazy. So you can go to ultimatelongevity.com/Ben to get your hands on these grounding mats. You can do mattress, pillow, blankets, a whole bunch of other valuable tools to help you bring your inflammation down and jumpstart your healing process. Again, it's ultimatelongevity.com/Ben. Well, folks, you and I, or the average American at least, spend an average of 90% of time indoors, breathing around 30,000 gallons of air daily. According to the EPA, indoor air can be 2 to 5 times more polluted than outdoor air, and in some cases 100 times more polluted, especially like your home gym where you're breathing in even more air. This can be a serious issue. Data shows that air pollution is responsible for nearly 7 million premature deaths around the world. So you need air purifying technology, and the one that I like as a standalone system that doesn't require you to go re-outfit your entire home's AC system or ducts is called the Air Doctor. The Air Doctor filters out dangerous contaminants and allergens like pollen, pet dander, dust mites, and mold, so your lungs don't need to. Their Ultra HEPA filter has been independently tested to remove 99.99% of tested bacteria and viruses and virtually 100% of particles as small as 0.003 microns. They also feature whisper jet fans, 30% quieter than normal ordinary air purifiers, and they are extremely affordable and accessible. Furthermore, they're going to give you up to 39% off of one of their extremely impressive and efficacious air filters, or up to $300 off today. Here's how you lock this in. You go to airdoctorpro.com/BenG. You can get one with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund, minus shipping, but you're going to love it. airdoctorpro.com/BenG. You'll get up to 39% off or up to $300 off. So lock it in today, folks. You'll enjoy it. Clean air is something everybody deserves. You can get it with the Air Doctor.
So I also wanted to ask you about some of these exercise protocols that you've looked into and that I know you've kind of studied yourself or implemented in your own routine. And I'm curious, when it comes to resistance training, and especially resistance training aimed at avoiding what we were just talking about, right? Like age-related loss of muscle mass or muscle function, what kind of strategies you've found to give people the most bang for their buck from an exercise standpoint?
Yeah. So especially as we age, my first goal in the gym is to avoid injury. You know, you heal less quickly, and I just... First goal, don't hurt yourself. But going from there, I'm a big advocate in whole body resistance training with occasional Tabata sessions thrown in, you know, like kind of rowing machine. I quite like those evil devices. And of course, I think it's great to spend a lot of time outdoors and in nature. I like to spend a lot of time hiking in Wyoming and Maine. But if you said, what is your preferred method in terms of exercise? I'd say it's resistance training. And in the nutshell, I incorporate methods that are intended to allow you to train intensely and safely. So one method I use is hierarchical sets. Another is, we mentioned earlier, is occasional eccentric movements. Another would be kettlebells. Another would be blood flow restriction training, and I'm a big advocate of that. Another would be electrical muscle stimulation, and I quite like vibration platform as well.
What are the hierarchical sets?
Well, essentially, these are typically done. You can do as many sets as you like, but they're typically done three. And another advocate, in fact, is Art Devaney for this. He's a fascinating fellow. And
he's a super cool dude. I got a chance to hang out with him at this last year's Paleo FX, one of the fittest, most ripped. I don't know, how old is he now? 80 something?
Yeah, he's old.
Yeah.
But he's super cool, right? And so he visited IHMC to do a STEM Talk interview, and we were talking about weightlifting. And it turns out we both are advocates for these hierarchical sets. And essentially what they are is the first set, you've selected a weight that you can knock out about 15 really perfect reps, right? And, the next set, you pick a weight that you can achieve about 8. And the next set, maybe 4 or 5. And, in my case, I don't go to failure on these. You know, I don't want to entrain failure. It's always when I'm near failure that I get hurt anyway. You know, it's when your form goes out the window.
Right.
So I don't do that. And I like it because the first set is almost a very intense warm-up, right? I mean, you know, you're not going to – I feel well within the safety zone when you're doing 15. And but doing those 15 and then the 8 and the 4, by the time I'm to the 4, the last set, I've typically fatigued out most of the slow twitch muscle fiber, and I'm being able to hit some of the fast twitch, which are hard to hit safely. So a lot of my exercise methods that I just rattled off to you in a boring list, they're really mostly all about how do you get at fast twitch. Because as we age, what we lose mostly is fast twitch. And this is why, you know, you have the increased falls. You know, it's not that old people are spectacularly uncoordinated. We're all out of shape all the time. When we're walking, we're all in a compromised spot. But young people correct it with their fast twitch muscles so quickly and so well that they're hardly even aware of it. And you see an older person, as they start to fall, they're almost running to catch themselves. And they're in a bad position. And so preservation of fast twitch is very, very important.
You know, this is something that I really like the idea of. So you would start with a relatively lightweight, like 15 reps. You rest just a very short period of time, like as long as it yeah. takes to just add more weight. Or if you're on a
right,
machine to change the pin. Then you would do 8 with a heavier weight, and then you would do like 4 to 5 with another heavier weight. And the rest period, it sounds to me like that's just barely long enough to reload creatine phosphate or ATP stores. Then you go on to the next set.
Yep, you've got it. That's exactly
how you do it. Yeah. So that's the hierarchical set. And you said you also use blood flow restriction training?
Yes, and I use it quite a bit. And I've turned a lot of my friends onto it, both in sport, you know, and older people, for folks engaged in sort of casual sport, people involved in elite sport, they're often performing relatively injured. And, you know, they don't have the option of not performing. This is either their job or it's an important part of their life. And they want to maintain muscle mass. So what I like about blood flow restriction training, and again, we're talking about restriction, not occlusion.
Right.
So we're restricting the venous outflow
with a strap that you would wrap around
right.
like an arm or a leg.
A cuff that looks kind of like a blood pressure cuff. It's not one, and you shouldn't use one for this purpose. But there's a cuff, and you put it on the limb as high up as you can, and you pressurize it either with a motorized pump system like Katsu uses or with a hand pump like Gobi Strong uses. And again, I said you're occluding the venous outflow of blood distal to the occlusion site. Now, you know, the benefit of this is profound in that you can do your workout with maybe 20% of your normal weight. So for each exercise in each person, that will vary. The amount of weight you can lift is a function partly of how tightly restricted the band is and how much the weight is, of course. And the proper protocol for this would be high rep sets. So I try to do 3 sets of 30. But if I can do 30 the first set, I probably maybe don't get to 30 on the second set, right? And the third set, maybe I get to 20. But by then, the hydrogen ions are causing a great burning sensation, right? The using the lightweight is a wonderful advantage. So also when you're on the road, you know, I travel a lot. So I go to a hotel and I see, oh, they have little blue weights. Oh, this is going to be great. And
the cute little pink concrete dumbbells with the Lycra lining on them.
Yeah, that's always so much fun. And the leg press machine goes to like 300 or something, you know. So with BFR, blood flow restriction, lightweights are all you need, you know. So even a strong man is doing curls with like 15 or 20 pounds, because that would imply that you would curl, you know, 80 or 100, right? So I like this. It preserves your joints. And as you get older, your joints are the limiting factor for an aging athlete to stay in the game and to keep exercising. It tends to be orthopedic problems that take us out. So, you know, and then you asked, I think you mentioned, how does it work, right? And there's a lot of theorizing about this, but, you know, there's certainly mechanical tension. But I would say metabolic stress signals a large number of mechanisms. Essentially, when you're doing this, you're sending a huge stress signal. And so when you test this, you find reduced protein breakdown compared to traditional weightlifting. So you're not tearing the muscle down and then waiting for a few days for it to build up. You're trying to have the build phase without the teardown. You find accumulations of metabolites. You see decreased myostatin. I mentioned that earlier. Myostatin pops its head up all over the place. And when you use BFR, your myostatin is diminished, the expression of the myostatin. You see suppression of FOXO transcription. You know, you see a great proliferation of satellite cells. And for me, one thing I'm interested in, you see increased fast twitch fiber recruitment, because your body thinks you're an extremist. Like, what are you doing here? Right. And so there's nothing left in the tank. And, you know, tremendous nitrous oxide production, heat shock proteins, and just it's fun, right? You get this huge pump, you know, and it lasts for a while, like an hour or two. So I enjoy it. Nobody really knows the relative contribution of each of the things I just named. We all know they're in the mix. There's also a big increase in IGF-1. We know they're all in the mix, but we don't know what the blend is. One of the research things that we're going to do here in the next couple months, we have a project that's led by Dr. Adam Ahnes at the Andrews Institute, which is located nearby. And so Adam, myself, and Jim Stray Gunderson, an expert on using blood flow restriction with athletes, is going to look at whether BFR is increasing the mobilization of stem cells from marrow. Because we see healing effects, and we're wondering, is some of the effect caused by and some of the recovery effect a consequence of increased stem cell activity directly? So that should be interesting.
That's super fascinating.
And again, I like both the Gobi Strong system and the Katsu system. They're both just excellent. You know, I think Gobi Strong is still giving a 15% discount with the discount code IHMC. We don't gain money from them or anything, of course. But okay. They're both good.
Cool.
They're both primo. Katsu and Gobi Strong, both really good.
And those are the ones that you can actually adjust the millimeters of mercury of pressure on. So rather than just like wrapping something around your arm like a tourniquet, like I used to do back in the days when I was a bodybuilder, these things you can actually micro adjust the exact amount of pressure on each limb, right?
Yes, and that's more important than some pundits let on, right? So it allows you to be consistent, and consistency and repeatability, I think, is pretty important.
Cool. I'll put a link to those in the show notes if you guys want those with Ken's discount code. Just go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/KenFord. Now, Ken, one of the thing you briefly mentioned was kettlebells. Do you have like a favorite kettlebell exercise that you feel gives you the most bang for your buck? Because like, the one that I swear by when I walk in, this is like my warm up a lot of times at the gym for hip mobility and for bone density and for shoulder range of motion is I'll go into a gym and the very first thing I do is 5 to 10 Turkish get ups on each side with the kettlebell because it's just moving me through full range of motion on both sides. But I'm curious if you have a favorite for the kettlebells.
Well, first of all, let me say, I think your choice and the way you use the Turkish get-up is wonderful. And it would be in my top three if I had the shoulder integrity and not the shoulder to do that. But I completely appreciate the Turkish get-up. In my case, I do mostly carries and swings. And I'm an advocate for the hard style kettlebell or Russian style kettlebell workouts. And what I like about the swing is it's less boring than most sort of aerobic workouts. And it gives each of us the rare opportunity to express physical power without negative societal ramifications. And I just like it. I like the explosion coming up, you know, out of the hip hinge. But you know, if you said what's my very favorite, and I like it's kind of like sprinting. I like that about it too. I like to sprint. But I guess if you said what's my very favorite, I would say carries. I like heavy farmer's walks. And my number one kettlebell exercise is the bottoms up carry, where you carry the bell by the horn and the bell is upside down, not racked on your forearm, but directly vertical above the horn. And so this hits all kinds of activation all over your body. I think it was Stuart McGill that told me in his testing, it activated more different muscle than any other thing he'd seen. And it requires some physical ability, not just strength, but some degree of athleticism if the weight is heavy, because you have to deal with the center of mass. So as you walk around the gym, besides looking peculiar, you're getting quite a challenge. You know, the thing wants to flop. Yeah. I liked that so much that I overdid it and tweaked my elbow. So I've been dealing with elbow drama, which I'm sure is a direct result of my love of that particular exercise.
Yeah, it's freaking hard, the bottoms up movements, but they're incredible for especially stability. Like I'll do a bottoms up walking lunge with a lighter kettlebell. And I mean, you can use a tiny, tiny kettlebell with that and feel every muscle in your body twitching. So I love it. I love that you're into these different forms of exercise, because it's, you know, you're definitely a man who is who's studying up quite a bit on anti-aging protocols. And I like to hear that I'm at least doing a few things right on my end. Now, speaking of anti-aging, you sent me a grip strength article yesterday that I thought was fascinating. Can you talk about that one? Because that kind of had to do with aging as well.
Yeah, that article is so depressing. But, it's sort of part of a bigger issue. The article I sent you noted that it was about grip strength in millennials, and it noted that they were much, not just a little, but much weaker than their fathers. And, this is not a good state of affairs, and not substantially stronger than their wives. Wow. So it said in 1985, the average 30 to 34-year-old could squeeze on a dynamometer at least 31 pounds more than a woman of the same age. But today, as I said, it's about the same. There's a slight edge for the guys, but very little. And they're not even close to their fathers, right? Their fathers would just crush them. And the societal response to this in academia, this is published in a journal, wasn't shock and dismay, and it wasn't wonder. If they tested thumb strength, I bet you the millennials would have strong thumbs from all their texting.
Yeah, exactly.
But the response wasn't what I would expect. The response was, well, we need to change the standard now. So now they're rewriting the standards. So what's considered normal for a 30-year-old, they're going to lower it a lot. So normal is a dangerous word, and it's something – so, I guess I'll mention it. I don't usually want to talk about it, but you don't want to be normal. Homer Simpson's normal. No, normal is the average of society. And if you walk around in an airport, as I unfortunately do, my eye falls on a lot of normal people. And you don't want to be normal.
Yeah, I agree. We want to take people from good to great on this show. Now, when you're talking about grip strength, that's one of the reasons I always, even when I travel, I throw a suspension strap in my bag, and I have, rings hanging outside my patio. I've got a pull-up bar in the door of my office. I've got a yoga trapeze swing to my wife's chagrin hanging above the dining room table. I pretty much hang, and my kids see me doing this too, which is great because my kids see me doing it, and so they stop to hang during the day, and they just consider it a form of play, right? You stop, you hang, you toy around, you swing like a monkey. And, I don't know what came first, the chicken or the egg, when it comes to grip strength and accelerated aging. But in my opinion, it's one of the best things you can do for your body is to maintain good grip strength. And for those of you listening in, I'll put a link to that grip strength article that was on NPR, I believe, in the show notes. But I just wanted to touch on the importance of grip strength. Before I asked you one other question about muscle loss or maintaining muscle mass, and that would be the fact that I know we touched a little bit about how you've looked into the loss of muscle mass in space, And I'm curious if, other than us rushing out to buy an exoskeleton to hang in our closet, if you found anything else from like the space research that you think would be really palatable or applicable for people who aren't necessarily astronauts.
Well, I think in the near term, the most applicable outcome are the technologies, you know, the exercise devices, like I mentioned, and also, you know, electrical muscle stimulation devices, which I'm a big advocate of.
I'm hooked up to electrical muscle stimulation right now while we're talking, actually.
Good man.
I'm sitting in a chair while we're podcasting, which I usually have a standing workstation at home, but I'm at an NAD injection clinic getting an 8-hour long IV. So I've got EMS hooked up to both my legs and my calves. So literally, as we're talking right now, I'm stimulating primarily slow twitch muscle fiber, but still getting a big blood flow effect.
Mm-hmm. And they're adjustable. You know, I'm particularly a fan of the power dot unit. And, you know, it's just so much sleeker. You know, I used to use the Compex unit and it was fine, but it's this big clunky 1980s looking thing with cables all over the place. And the software is built into the machine. You know, you're not updating that software, and there's not a way to interface to it or to write code for it. Whereas the PowerDot runs on your phone. So, you know, the world is your oyster. You can change the protocols. They can constantly update the software. And it's a much more powerful computer than came with these other devices. And
probably far more portable too, right?
Oh, it's hugely portable. It's the size of your phone. You got your phone. And it looks like something Apple would make, you know, the packaging. So you have your phone and you've got the power dot, and it's partly wireless through Bluetooth. And you've got a few wires, but, you know, you're talking about you're using EMS now. I recently used my power dot on a very long flight, you know, a flight to Dubai. And, you know, those flights are just flat out unhealthy. So I was using it on my legs, and I hadn't realized that it was causing distress for the person. And I was in business class, so she wasn't too close to me, but I think she was concerned about this man with cables and wires and limbs twitching, you know. So she pushed the button for the flight attendant, and I got the opportunity to explain it all to this lovely flight attendant. Who seemed really interested in it.
Yeah, I've been there, brother. I've been there. I've had all manner of things strapped to my body and coming out multiple orifices on airplanes. And you just have to pretend. You have to dance like nobody's watching, basically.
Yeah, you got it. You know, one of the things I like so much about EMS and what sort of drives my interest in it is that it, in general, induces a preferential recruitment of the fast motor units. And that's because the axons are physically larger in size. So thereby, all things being equal, they have lower electrical resistance than the smaller axons that you see on the type 1 fibers. And so, you know, you can focus it on the fast twitch pretty easily. And that's interesting, again, as one gets older or if you're in a recovery or injured state.
So when you're looking at some of the other things that you do, in addition to, you know, the power dot that you might be considering as almost like a biohack, right? Are there any more advanced exercise protocols, supplements, devices, sure, things that you've discovered? Because you're a pretty scientific fellow, so I always like to pick the brains of a guy like you who's steeped in the research on stuff like this. What else have you found to be big wins when it comes to emerging tech?
Well, you know, I'm big on supplements in general, but very focused. You know, I don't take a shotgun approach, and I do a lot of testing, as you can imagine. You know, one size doesn't fit all, and what's good for one isn't good for the other. But I think an intelligent supplementation program, especially depending on your diet, you know, so for people that are in ketosis, carnitine, both LCAR and the tartarate form, I think are important. I also use vibration training. You know, it seems kind of tedious, or people look at it and say, what is that guy doing? But there's a big literature that would lead one to believe there could be benefit. I have the PowerPlate brand in my office, and use it quite a bit.
That's what I have in my basement, the PowerPlate.
Yeah, I have the small one. You know, they just came out with a portable one. You know, it packs up in a bag. You can take it easily on a plane, but
oh, really?
it'd be great for a road trip. You know, so I can throw it in my car. It just came out like a couple months ago, and it's really cool. It works just the same, but it doesn't have the vertical stanchion. You know, that you can hang on to.
Right.
But, you know, you wouldn't need you don't really need the vertical. It's more of a safety feature. And it works just like the regular one. I like it because it hits muscles that otherwise are super hard to hit, and it hits them in different ways. And there's a big literature showing a benefit, especially in older men and women, and then in young resistance trained or athletic young men and women, the advantage really diminishes in the upper body, but you still see a strong advantage in legs. And of course, that's because you're typically closer to the vibration source. You know, you're probably standing on it.
Give me an example of something you do on a vibration platform.
I like to do like pistols, if you know what those are. And I like to do squats, and I like to do sort of explosive push-ups on it. And you know, when I'm doing push-ups on it, I have the pad on it. You know, the little pad.
Yep.
But when you're standing on it with any kind of footwear, you really shouldn't use the pad. And I think where it, in a relatively strong person, where it makes the biggest difference is in the legs. You know, when you look at the literature for athletes, you don't see a big difference in upper body benefit. But also there's probably lymph system benefits apart from muscle. And probably cardiovascular benefits. I think it's interesting, and it's low impact, and it's something you can do during the day without much trouble if one wants to.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I didn't know about the portable one. I'll hunt it down and link to it in the show notes for those of you listening in. What I do often is I've got it next to my office, so I'll just go in there and do some Hindu squats and some push-ups with my hands up on the platform and a few little moves that just kind of get blood flowing. It's a great device. Now, another thing that you had mentioned was L-carnitine, and that one's, you know, relatively well known when it comes to doing things like improving mitochondrial function or fatty acid metabolism, as what you called like an exercise mimetic. But what do you think about other things that are called SARMs that are now used? You know, that they term these as like exercise in a pill. Like there's one that I wrote an article on called GW5015, and they say that massively improves endurance in mice. I'm curious what your thoughts are about safety and efficacy with things like that.
Sure. Well, you know, this is a fascinating subject, and you know, back to L-carnitine just for a moment. You know, the LCAR version of that can be seen as a kind of an exercise mimetic, primarily by function of, you know, it strongly induces muscle glucose uptake and fatty acid oxidization. And that's why it couples nicely with a ketogenic diet. I just wanted to give you that aside, but
interesting. And when you say LCAR, just to clarify for people, that's acetyl L-carnitine.
Yes, exactly. And then you mentioned SARMs, and those are selective androgen reuptake modulators. And SARMs are very interesting. They're, again, mostly developed for the older population who are suffering loss of muscle and for people with various diseases, wasting diseases, as well as people with cancer. They're very interesting. There are several in phase 2 and I think one in phase 3 trials. What to say about SARMs? Well, they're less selective than one would hope. So one of the things that slowed their advance into widespread use is in reasonable doses, you do get some degree of shutdown. In other words, they reduce the endogenous production of testosterone. And the thought was they wouldn't. And so they're less selective than had hoped. The new ones are getting better and better and better. And it's important to note these are currently research items, not for human consumption. You also mentioned GW501516. So GW is not a SARM. It's typically marketed as a SARM, but it's not a SARM. And it's very, very different technically. A mechanism of action is completely unrelated. So that's a fascinating substance. It's in a category of exercise mimetics that are PPAR delta agonists. And essentially, these improve endurance. And, you know, the one way to think of it is they push the wall back. You know, we all know the saying, he hit the wall, right? So what this does is essentially pushes the wall back. And in people ingesting a PPAR delta agonist, which again, they shouldn't be doing because it's a research drug, if you test them, you will see signs of exercise. So it looks like exercise. And this is why they call them exercise mimetics. You know, you see improved mitochondrial function and increased fatty acid metabolism. And, you know, in fact, ketogenic diets do both of those things as well. Increased endurance, reduced inflammation, lower blood glucose levels, interestingly, right? And of course, they're banned in sport. The interesting thing to me is that 501516 is not the end of the line. So that substance is never going to find its way to the market. And study on it has been discontinued for a wide range of reasons. But that category of drug is under active development. And one can expect much more focused PPAR delta agonists to come to the fore.
Do you use both of those yourself?
No. GW501516 is the exercise mimetic that we mentioned. And, you know, I'm not really interested in endurance activities that much. I try to get whatever benefit I would get from the ketogenic diet. It's important to note that in mouse models, GW gives a tremendous benefit and in endurance. And by anecdotal report, also is beneficial in endurance for humans. And then the SARMs are still early days. You know, they're also going to get better quickly.
So when it comes to endurance, that's actually another question I wanted to ask you. Do you do any cardio at all, or do you have any like research based approach to cardiovascular training for things like VO2 max or lactate threshold or anything along those lines?
Yeah, I don't care about VO2 max, but the kind of cardio I like to do is sprinting, kettlebell swings, Tabata sessions, you know, or short sessions on the rowing machine, like the 500 meter. It's, you know, it's almost a sprint, you know. I really like that. What I really don't like are the chronic cardio. You know, you see people in the gym and you see them. Well, they're not really gyms anymore. They're like fitness centers now.
Right.
But anyway, you see, there's no gymnastics equipment in there, but they call it a gym. But you see the dude on the elliptical machine and he's watching TV. He's got his back scratcher. He's probably has a snack with him on the machine. And he's sort of going at about 20% VO2 max or something for 2 hours. And then the machine tells him, congratulations, you burned 600 calories. Well, there's so much wrong with that whole story. So that's sort of the opposite of my approach. If I want to do that kind of long duration stuff, I like to hike in the mountains. And that kind of thing. Otherwise, I'm into short, efficient exercise.
Yeah, I am too. I think dipping into stamina every now and again, like doing like that hike in the mountains, is a good idea. But I completely agree. Most people overdo it. Although before sitting here in this chair for 8 hours, I decided to opt for the metabolic boost rather than the weight training. And so I'll typically do like a high intensity interval training session when I know I want to increase my post exercise oxygen consumption for a long period of time after. So if I'm going to be sedentary for a long time, that's when I'll choose like the high intensity interval training type of approach. But Yeah, for the most part, you actually do get a lot more out of some of the other strategies that you talked about. So, this is all super fascinating, and I know you take a lot of deep dives with people on your own show, from, you know, scientists to engineers to people in exercise technology and beyond. You say you select your guests with, I think, what you call a double secret selection committee to be among the most interesting people on the planet, especially working in science and technology and medicine. And I'm curious, if people want to go, and I'll put a link to your shows over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/KenFord. But if people want to go and take a listen to an episode, do you have, I know this is always tough, it's like choosing a favorite child, but a favorite episode that you think would be just really mind-blowingly compelling for the listeners of my show?
Well, for your show, I think the most beneficial episodes would be those about health, nutrition, exercise. You know, so we had a deep dive on blood flow restriction training with Jim Stray Gunderson. We've had all kinds of shows touching on intermittent fasting and ketogenic diets and exogenous ketones. One of the shows that I like best, even though, you know, it's hard to pick, as you said, it's like, what kid do you like best? And I wouldn't have a favorite, except about 2 weeks ago, our guest from episode number 10, Barry Barish, was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics. And the prize was for his work on detection of gravitational waves. So right now you got to go with Barry, right? But, wow. You know, for your guests, for your audience, I think the health and performance shows. And it's cool, you know, STEM Talk won first place in the annual People's Choice Podcast Awards a couple weeks ago in the category of science and medicine. And I think it was the runner-up in the overall category.
Oh, wow.
So that's kind of cool.
Dude, that's cool. You guys must be doing something right. And obviously, you study up on this stuff quite a bit yourself. And I think people are going to go nuts over the show notes I've created for this one, because I've got plenty of resources for those of you listening in to find out more about Ken, and also everything from the vibration plates that you can take on airplanes to acetyl carnitine to ketones and Arx Fit machines, much, much more. So I'll put a link to all that over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/KenFord. And in the meantime, Ken, thank you for coming on the show and sharing all this stuff with us. You are one fascinating dude.
Well, thanks, Ben. I had a good time.
All right, folks. Well, until next time, I'm Ben Greenfield, along with Ken Ford of the IHMC, signing out from BenGreenfieldFitness.com. Have an amazing week.
You've been listening to the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast. Go to BenGreenfieldFitness.com for even more cutting-edge fitness and performance advice.